In January 2011, a group of strangers started a revolution in Cairo's Tahrir Square that mesmerized the world. 4 years later, we're still trying to make sense of Egypt's revolution and the Arab Spring. What happened to the people who led the uprising? Why didn't it work? Will its ideals survive? And might it still work in the long run? In the new book, Once Upon a Revolution, an Egyptian Story, journalist Thanasi Kambanas tells the inside story of the Egyptian Revolution. He brings to life the activists who led Egypt to the brink of freedom and the dark, powerful forces that, for the time being, stopped them short. Again, the title of the book is Once Upon a Revolution, an Egyptian Story. It's a great pleasure to welcome Thanasi Kambanas to the program. Thank you very much for being with us.
Great to be with you, Joe.
What brought you to want to tell this tale?
I had been covering the Arab world for more than a decade, always sort of hopeful for it, on the lookout for some kind of real positive change, which never came. And when the revolutionaries and these crowds of young people took over Tahrir Square, it was really a sort of history-defying occasion. And not just as a reporter, but as a human being and as someone who had studied history and grown up through the fall of the Berlin Wall and the end of the Cold War, this was clearly one of those once-in-a-lifetime moments. And I actually left my newborn daughter and wife and son in New York and headed to Tahrir Square and spent much of the next 3 years there watching events unfold.
And obviously, events are still unfolding. So let's talk about what brought you there and what you discovered and what the last 3 years has been like, in the sense of, have we seen a major transformation?
Well, it's a inspiring story, and it's also a very depressing story. Essentially, something nearly impossible happened. A lot of people really changed entirely their approach to life and to government. These citizens who had been trained for generations to shut up and obey broke through the wall of fear. That's what the sort of became the cliche in Egypt to say. But they really did break through the wall of fear, and they confronted an authoritarian system, both philosophically and metaphorically, but also very literally. Many of them were beaten, killed, tortured, imprisoned in this process. So something ineluctable changed in the position that citizens take towards their state, and that's the inspiring part of the story. Now, the depressing part of the story, which most of your listeners will know, is that slowly but surely over the 4 years since Tahrir Square first erupted, is the steady and insidious reassertion of the old regime and the old system. What we saw is a very patient cat and mouse waiting game practiced by the police, the military, the old ruling elites, and eventually, less than three years in fact, from the original uprising, there was a coup deposing the first and only elected civilian president in Egypt, and now here we are a year and a half later, where there's a military strongman back in power, ruling, in fact, with a more narrow, more capricious, more militarized dictatorship than the one Hosni Mubarak presided over.
When you look at what happened in Tahrir Square in January of 2011, what were the ingredients to bring that all together? Because a lot of it was chance, wasn't it?
The real bottom line of this was that the country was so gravely and bitterly misruled that it pushed otherwise normal, otherwise complacent people to a breaking point. How I like to explain it is, if you look around at poorly governed countries, people seem willing to accept being mired in poverty if they have a sort of enough freedom and enough political voice to feel like they have a say over their lives, or vice versa. They're willing to accept political repression if they're getting a certain amount of prosperity and quality of life in exchange for that. What happened in Egypt was, for so long, really for 60 years, these military regimes promised a lot, and at first they did deliver. They took a completely impoverished rural nation and brought it a bit, kicking and screaming, into a bit of modern standard of living. But then for 50 years, it was just decline and humiliation and routine torture. And eventually what happened is so many people couldn't take it and couldn't see a future for themselves or their children, so that when a very tiny group of activists did this initial protest, even they were shocked and surprised by how many regular folks suddenly were willing to join them and take on the police.
You wonderfully described that a moment ago, but I just want to go back and look at the question that so many around the world have asked, which is, and especially in this country, when the term Arab Spring came about, I'm curious as to what it was about this event to make it almost as an example as to what was possible. So for so many other activists in so many other situations to look and say, yes, we can make a difference. And yet we look at so many different situations where we think to ourselves, well, if this doesn't get people rioting in the streets, then what will?
The sort of inspiring thing to me about what happened in Egypt is that in 2010, the last year before this revolt, it wasn't the worst year in Egyptian history. It was sort of a average middling year of, you know, sort of not the worst repression, not the worst violence, and yet the cumulative neglect and grievance of the way the state treated its people drove them to this breaking point. And for me, as an American, I mean, I've spent my whole life sort of decrying or noticing that people seem apathetic. People never seem, sort of as you put it, never seem really driven, not even to revolt in our case, but just to get politically engaged. You know, what does it take to make a regular half apathetic, half engaged citizen to get involved? And what happened in Egypt? There was no good reason for it. It wasn't that, you know, suddenly there were massive massacres or some kind of crazy event to propel people. And for me, that was what was so exciting about it. It was sort of the maturation of a very long process of a small group of people trying to get the rest of their fellow citizens engaged and worked up about the injustice to which they were subject, and giving them a sort of channel, an opportunity through which to engage. And this is one of the sort of less chronicled or less understood parts of this story, of the story of the uprising. We saw the huge crowds in Tahrir chanting, you know, we want the end of the regime and the dictator out. But there was a really tremendous positive side, constructive side to this too. These folks were out there and they were actually talking about the kind of social democracy they wanted to build, the kind of justice system they imagined. And that to me was the most unusual and unexpected part of it, right? They weren't just nihilistic, let's get rid of the old dictatorship. They were saying, you know what, we've been told for three generations not to think for ourselves and not to have expectations of our state and our government. And in fact, we do. We're full of ideas. We're full of ideals, but also of sort of nitty-gritty notions of how to bring those to life. And that's something that I don't think you can replicate or force. But it's sort of it's almost like magic when it comes into being.
In the book, you talk about and you tell these tales of two very different revolutionaries, and you intertwine them and tell us the story. So give us a little bit about that background and how you identify these individuals.
I followed about a dozen people from the beginning of Tahrir Square, and what I did was I sought out folks who were involved in political, trying to be political leaders, right? So they were leading the revolt, but they were also trying to come up with a political blueprint. When the sort of story came to an end with the return of the old dictatorship, I focused my book on the two who were the most, to me, interesting and representative. One was a Muslim brother who came from three generations of Muslim Brotherhood activism, but because he was such a critical thinker and someone who was personally very religious but dedicated to the idea of a secular state, he broke with the Muslim Brotherhood leadership and was eventually expelled. He was a sort of your sort of quintessential street-level rabble-rouser. He was always out there at the front of the barricades chanting, but was sort of naive and utopian and impractical when it came to how to translate that into lasting political power. The other character I focus on was a man named Bassem Kamel, who was a 40-year-old architect, sort of bourgeois, very apolitical until age 39. He had a lot at stake, much more at stake than a lot of the young people who took to the streets. And he became a founder of a social democratic party, a sort of very quintessential insider who wanted to find a way to create incremental change from within the system. He actually was one of only four revolutionary youth who won a seat in parliament in 2011, 2012, and today he's running for parliament again. So we sort of get the moderate incremental insider and we get the rabble-rousing outsider, both of them failing to achieve their goals by the end, but still fighting for them today.
So with that said, as we look to today, for the average Egyptian, how do they feel about the accomplishments of that time And what ultimately will survive from it?
Well, that's a big question. And, you know, right now, at this moment, the vast majority of Egyptians have applauded the return of strongman rule, which is a sort of depressing reality. But there's two really important things to keep one's eye on today. One is that the core grievances that led Egypt to explode in 2011 are entirely present today in exactly the same formulation, the same failures to feed, clothe, educate, and provide health care for people, mass poverty, corruption, you know, impetuous, capricious abuse by a military dictatorship. All those conditions are still in place. So there's unfortunately no reason structurally to think, well, life will get better and people will be satisfied. The other thing that's really changed and is kind of incredible is that the political education that Egyptians conjured into being against unbelievable odds starting in 2011 is still taking place. So we have, you know, the characters in my book, Moaz and Bassem, still agitating politically, even as upwards of 40,000 people are in prison today for political crimes like protesting without a permit. And yet, despite unprecedented historical levels of repression and state violence against dissent, we still have people protesting, speaking out in public at a level that didn't happen for 60 years before. So something has snapped and changed in the way at least the small group of Egyptians sees themselves. And so I can't be optimistic and say in the future, for sure, we're going to see something better in Egypt or even in the rest of the Arab world. But I can say with a lot of confidence that no dictator can rule Egypt again with a sort of lazy, offhanded repression of Mubarak. They're either going to have to do as Sisi is today and work 10 times as hard to keep the lid on it, or they're going to face ultimately a real sort of overwhelming demand from their people for some system that is more accountable, more fair, and not necessarily democratic as we see it, not necessarily liberal as we see it, but certainly a better place to live than Egypt has been for the last six decades.
Why do you think, when it comes to the ideals that were fought for in the revolution, that a natural leader or leaders did not emerge?
Well, that's a great question, because it's one of the sort of baked-in faults of the uprising that has to be addressed if it's going to go better or differently in the future. Part of it is that the propaganda of Egypt's military regimes has for 60 years has very effectively peddled the idea that politics is something selfish and parochial, and that the true servants of the nation, people who care, come from the military. They have the national interest at heart. They're not in pursuit of individual power. So anyone who even styles themselves as a leader, as a political leader, is subject to being dismissed as a glory-seeking, selfish person. Unfortunately, a lot of the young revolutionaries actually had sort of internalized this idea. So even as they were leading the demonstrations and leading the new political movements, they would say, I'm not a leader. I'm just speaking for the people. I don't want a chair. Don't think that I'm trying to be in charge here. If you want to be in charge, go ahead. And the result was that you had 20, 30, sometimes 50 different people speaking for the revolutionary youth. And it was almost like one of these scenes where everyone's in a doorway saying, no, after you. And in the end, what happened was that the military and the Muslim Brotherhood stormed through the door because the revolutionaries were so busy, trying to be polite to each other and not look like they were seeking glory and trying to be in charge.
When you follow these people and you spend so much time and you look at them and you look at their stories, how does it change you? How does it change you in your opinions as you're writing this book?
Personally, I lost a lot of my cynicism. I'm a 40-year-old. I spent most of my adult life covering U.S. foreign policy and the sort of post 9/11 wars in the Islamic world, and I had grown quite cynical about human nature, about the potential for change. I had certainly sort of given up on the idea that you could have great cataclysmic positive change or the kind of sort of mass engagement of citizenship that I saw in Egypt. So I have to say today, I mean, even if I'm not optimistic about the short-term political fortunes of Egypt, I am much more optimistic about human nature than I was on January 24th, 2011.
The name of the book is Once Upon a Revolution, an Egyptian Story. It is published by Simon and Schuster. Thanasi Kambanis, thank you so much for being with us this morning. A great pleasure.
Great to talk to you, Joe.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book, Once Upon a Revolution, published by Simon and Schuster. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.